Our lesson this morning begins in the 37th chapter of the book of Genesis. Listen for the word of the Lord. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Once, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream that I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaths gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to them, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent Joseph from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," Joseph said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Here ends the first reading.
And so the story continues. Remember that Joseph was 17 years old when his brothers sold him to the Ishmaelite traders, who in turn sold him into slavery in Egypt to Pharaoh's captain of the guard, Potiphar. Things initially went well for the dutiful and hardworking young man, who earned promotion after promotion in his master's household. But then it all fell apart when his master's wife falsely implicated Joseph in her unsuccessful attempt to seduce the handsome young servant. Joseph was thrown into prison. There, however, he gained a reputation as an interpreter of dreams. That old skill that had gotten him into trouble with his brothers some years before would now become his salvation, for he would help Pharaoh understand that his dreams were foretelling famine to come upon the land. And so Pharaoh placed Joseph in charge of the whole country, preparing for the famine. And indeed, after 7 years of plenty, the earth turned dry. But Egypt had plenty of food, for Joseph had stored away grain enough, not only for his own people, but for surrounding lands as well, even as far away as Canaan, where his father's family still lived. Facing starvation themselves, Joseph's brothers came to Egypt seeking food for survival. They were ushered into the presence of Joseph, whom they did not recognize, for he was now nearly 40 years of age. But he recognized them. After sending his brothers back and forth to their father with various requests, including bringing their youngest brother Benjamin back with them, he could keep silent no longer. We pick up the story now with the drama of Joseph's disclosure of his identity to his brothers. Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Send everyone away from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they came closer. He said, "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. God has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not delay. You shall settle in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, as well as your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. I will provide for you there, since there are 5 more years of famine to come, so that you and your household and all that you have will not come to poverty.'" Then he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. This is the word of the Lord. "I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." With these words, this most poignant of biblical stories reaches its climax. And then the great exonerating words that follow: "God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." And with this interpretation of his life and of God's participation in it, Joseph is moved to forgiveness of his brothers. It is a radical act, one that leaves his brothers in utter amazement, even disbelief. In relief and gratitude beyond measure, For they have come to know the depth of their sinful acts against their brother, and they have been spared revenge. And I dare say, as onlookers to this story, we must feel some amazement ourselves. For how can Joseph forgive this grievous act against him by his own brothers? How can he turn from that most common human need for revenge to a state of forgiveness and grace? We might begin to answer these questions in a couple of ways. In terms of concepts of modern psychology, we might say, indeed correctly, that over the years between being sold into slavery and now seeing his brothers again in need, Joseph has experienced a great deal of psychological growth. He is no longer the arrogant, egocentric youth of 17, the star of the popular contemporary musical Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. No, he is now a mature young man who is no longer the sun of his own universe. What might have been an egocentrism age-appropriate at 17 would feel unseemly now in a young man of nearly 40. Unfortunately, we know personally and on the public stages of entertainment, sports, and politics too many individuals who do not shed their adolescent egocentrism and become annoying, even dangerous to others. Just saying. But that is not the case with Joseph. From the dark pit of despair into which he had been cast by his brothers at 17, he has emerged into the light of day with wisdom. A desire for revenge has been replaced by an embrace of compassion. This psychological growth is necessary for the very positive resolution of the story of Joseph and his brothers, not only for Joseph, but also for his brothers, for they too have been humbled by the trials and tribulations of life that have brought them closer to their whole true selves. Joseph's and his brothers' lives have become intertwined into the great human virtue of humility. And it is in humility that their reconciliation can become possible. But there's another very important, perhaps for us as people of faith, even more important fact than our psychological growth out of egocentrism. And that is a corresponding growth in acknowledging, understanding, and accepting the activity of God in our lives. That activity is what we often call the providence of God. In what ways is God active in our lives? Joseph states it bluntly and forthrightly when he says to his brothers that they did not send him to Egypt, God did. In Joseph's world, God designed the whole thing, even the act of selling Joseph to slave traders. Now, I'm not sure I can accept God's activity in my life in that same way, seemingly pulling puppet strings at every turn. And perhaps some of you may have trouble along those lines as well. But over time, I have come to believe fervently that indeed God is at work in my life in ways I cannot understand at the moment, but that prove to be good for me even after I have felt at my lowest point. It's not that God has turned on me with cruel devices, but rather that in places where I have felt hurt or injured, God has helped me to see a broader perspective. Sometimes those perspectives have led to personal growth, to a shedding of those naively innocent egocentric ways of seeing myself. In apparent curses, there have been blessings, after all. We are helped to understand these things by brave people of faith who have led us by their own example. The English mystic Julian of Norwich lived at the end of the 14th century when Europe was plagued by the Black Death, the most devastating pandemic in human history, killing nearly 75 million people. Julian was a Benedictine nun who herself felt mortally ill. But during her illness, she had visionary experiences, and recording those visions, she wrote the first book by a woman in the English language. And so our good Lord answered to all the questions and doubts which I could raise, she wrote, saying most comfortingly, I may make all things well, and I can make all things well, and I shall make all things well, and I will make all things well, and you will see yourself that every kind of thing will be well. This is not cheery optimism or simple-minded faith. Rather, it is an affirmation of the mystery of God's love in all things, in all circumstances, even in the midst of personal and enormous human tragedies. With a perspective of God and God's own love being present in all things and through all things, Julian was able to live fully and faithfully. Like Joseph, Julian was in the stream with those who have come to see the pattern of divine love woven into life, bringing good out of evil. As a pastor and a therapist, I see many hurting people. They come to me in the midst of marital struggles, often around infidelity. They come to me in the midst of family conflict, often following the death of a parent and the ensuing struggles over inheritance. They come to me convinced that they are totally right and the people with whom they wrestle have it all wrong. And surely every one of them has a legitimate grievance needing redress and correction. But for real healing to occur, another dimension is usually needed, and that is for the wronged person to see a broader picture, one in which a God who loves us urges us toward ways that might be more naturally God's ways than ours. In his book, The Man Who Wrestled with God, the late John Sanford wrote, "When the pattern of our lives becomes clear to us, even the darkness and pain can be seen to have its proper place. In Joseph's case, the evil the brothers intended against him was intended by God for the purification of his soul, the destruction of his egocentricity, and for a way to bring him to Egypt where he would perform a great work." In our own spiritual journeys, perhaps we can remember those times when we were too harsh, perhaps too vengeful, maybe unforgiving, even indifferent. In our relationships with our children or our parents, our spouse or partner, our church community, our neighbors and colleagues, if we reflect long enough, perhaps we can recall such hurtful encounters. Brought to our knees and humbled by acknowledging our own egregious deeds, God comes inviting us to receive divine compassion in our brokenness. Looking back, we see how God has been at work within and among us, offering strength and meaning for our present and our future. All that Joseph's brothers have done comes into their awareness, and in the light of Joseph's compassion, they embrace. Reconciliation happens. Tears wash away years of pain and regret. The work of Archbishop Desmond Tutu in the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission was aimed at that as well. It allowed those who had committed egregious acts of racism during the time of apartheid to confess what they had done, to come to terms with their past, and then be restored to their humanity by the forgiveness of the human community. In South Africa, race inconceivably forgave race. In Northern Ireland, Protestant and Roman Catholic Christians finally laid down their guns. In the Amish community, devout parents prayed for the family of the man who had slaughtered their children. In these moments, we see Joseph's God living on in a new form. A wife grows to forgive her husband. A husband comes to forgive his wife. A friend forgives his friend, an enemy his enemy. In all those moments, God's joy of healing reconciliation breaks forth. In those moments of forgiveness, the wronged one ceases to be victim and becomes instead a co-creator with God of a brand new world. God knows we long for more of these moments, for we are plagued by violence and maddening destruction and discord all around. It is good for us to remember on this weekend of celebration of the highest ideals that have formed this great nation, this nation that we proclaim with hand held over heart to be under God, that with sobering trust in the providence of Almighty God, we might continue the quest toward humble reconciliation wherever the possibilities exist. Reconciliation becomes possible when we, individually and nationally, face our own frailties, vulnerabilities, and even hostilities, seeking to understand how and where divine purposes are at work and can be brought to bear. Joseph says to his brothers, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life." And here we have it. To preserve life. In the mystery of God's providence, Joseph holds the key of survival to the very ones who betrayed him. If Joseph and his brothers are not reconciled through forgiveness of each other, God's promises to Abraham and Sarah are broken. Life as God intended it does not move forward to their children and their children's children. That continuity rests with us today as surely as it did with our ancient forebears. So can we find ways that we, too, might be co-creators with God of a world as brand new and as good as the one we find in our Genesis? Amen.